criminal code, and that it had proven highly effective over the years. Your people are still a little unhappy with this, aren't they? Avi frowned. Ryan had faced him with the necessity of expressing his personal opinion or speaking the truth. They'd feel safer with our paratroops here. Man to man, Ryan. Truth won out, as it had to with Avi. Sure. They'll learn. It will take a few more weeks, but they will learn. The Arabs like the Swiss, and the key to the peace on this street is how our Arab friends feel. Now, will you tell me something? Clark's head moved fractionally at that. Maybe, Ryan answered, looking up the street. How much did you have to do with this? Nothing at all, Jack replied with a neutral coldness that matched the pace of the soldiers. It was Charlie Alden's idea, remember? I was just the messenger boy. So Elizabeth Elliot has told everyone. Avi didn't have to say any more. You wouldn't have asked the question unless you knew the answer, Avi. So why ask the question? Artfully done. General Ben Jakob sat down and waved for the waiter. He ordered two beers before speaking again. Clark and the other bodyguard weren't drinking. Your president pushed us too hard, threatening us with withholding our arms. He could have gone a little easier, I suppose. But I do not make policy, Avi. Your people made it happen when they murdered those demonstrators. That reopened a part of our own history that we wish to forget. It neutralized your congressional lobby. A lot of those people were on the other side of our own civil rights movement, remember? You forced us to move, Avi. You know that. Besides, Ryan stopped abruptly. Yes? Avi, this thing just might work. I mean, look around, Jack said as the beers arrived. He was thirsty enough that a third of it disappeared in an instant. It is a slim possibility, Ben Jakob admitted. You get better intel from Syria than we do, Ryan pointed out. I've heard that they've started saying nice things about the settlement. Very quietly, I admit. Am I right? If it's true. Avi grunted. You know the hard part about peace intel? Ben Jakob's eyes were focused on a distant wall as he contemplated. What? Believing it is possible? Jack nodded. That's one area where we have the advantage over you guys, my friend. We've been through all that. True, but the Soviets never said, proclaimed for two generations that they wanted to wipe you from the face of the earth. Tell the worthy President Fowler that such concerns are not so easily allayed. Jack sighed. I have. I did. Avi, I'm not your enemy. Neither are you my ally. Allies? We are now, General. The treaties are in force. General, my job is to provide information and analysis to my government. Policy is made by people senior to me, and smarter than me, Ryan added with deadpan irony. Oh? And who might they be? General Ben Jakob smiled at the younger man. His voice dropped a few octaves. You've been in the trade for what? Not even 10 years, Jack. The submarine business, what you did in Moscow, the role you played in the last election. Ryan tried to control his reaction but failed. Jesus, Avi. How the hell did he find that out? You cannot take the Lord's name in vain, Dr. Ryan, the deputy chief of the Mossad chided. This is the city of God. Those Swiss chaps might shoot you. Tell the lovely Miss Elliot that if she pushes too hard, we still have friends in your media, and a story such as that. Avi smiled. Avi, if your people mention that to Liz, she will not know what you were talking about. Rubbish, General Ben Jakob snorted. You have my word on that, sir. It was Brigadier Ben Jakob's turn to be surprised. That is difficult to believe. Jack finished off the beer. Avi, I've said what I can. Has it ever occurred to you that your information may not have come from an entirely reliable source? I will tell you this. I have no personal knowledge of what you alluded to. If there was any kind of deal, I was kept out of it. Okay, I have reason to believe that something may have happened, and I can even speculate what it might have been, but if I ever have to sit in front of a judge and answer questions, all I can say is that I do not know anything. And you, my friend, cannot blackmail someone with something that person doesn't know about. You'd have to do a pretty good selling job just to convince them that something had happened in the first place.
My God, what Moore and Ritter set up really was elegant, wasn't it?
Ryan set down his empty glass. Things like that never happen in real life, General. That's movie stuff. Look, Avi, maybe that report you have is a little on the thin side. The spectacular ones often are. Reality never quite keeps up with art, after all. It was a good play. Ryan grinned to carry the point.
Dr. Ryan, in 1972, the Black September faction of the Palestine Liberation Organization contracted the Japanese Red Army to shoot up Ben-Gurion Airport, which they did, killing off mainly American Protestant pilgrims from your island of Puerto Rico. The single terrorist taken alive by our security forces told his interrogators that his dead comrades and their victims would become a constellation of stars in the heavens. In prison, he purportedly converted himself to Judaism and even circumcised himself with his teeth, which speaks volumes for his flexibility, Brigadier General Avi Ben-Yakob added matter-of-factly. Do not ever tell me that there is something too mad to be true. I have been an intelligence officer for more than 20 years, and the only thing of which I am certain is that I have not yet seen it all.
Avi, even I'm not that paranoid. You have never experienced a Holocaust, Dr. Ryan. Oh? Cromwell and the potato famine don't count? Get off that horse, General. We're deploying the U.S. troops here. If it comes to that, there will be American blood on the Negev, or Golan, or whatever.
And what if,
Avi, you ask what if. If that what if ever happens, General, I will fly here myself. I used to be a Marine. You know I've been shot at before. There will be no second Holocaust, not while I live. My countrymen will not let it happen ever again. Not my government, Avi, my countrymen. We will not let that happen. If Americans have to die to help protect this country, then Americans will die to do so.
You said that to Vietnam.
Clark's eyes flared at that one, Ben-Yakob noticed.
You have something to say?
General, I'm no high official. Just a grunt with pretensions. But I got more combat time than anybody in this country of yours, and I'm telling you, sir, that what really scares me about this place is how you guys always fuck up the same way we did over there. We learned. You didn't. And what Dr. Ryan says is right. He'll come over. So will I if it comes to that.
I've killed my share of enemies, too, Clark told him in a low, quiet voice.
Another Marine? Avi asked lightly. Though he knew better.
Close enough, Clark said.
And I've kept current, as they say, he added with a smile.
What about your associate?
Avi motioned toward Chavez, who stood casually at the corner, eyeing the street.
Good as I ever was. So are those kids in the cav. But this war talk is all bullshit. You guys both know that.
You want security, sir. You settle your domestic problems. Peace will follow that like a rainbow after a storm.
Learn from your mistakes.
We had a 4,000-mile buffer to fall back through, General. It isn't that far from here to the Med. You'd better learn from our mistakes. Good news is, you are better able to make a real peace than we ever were. But to have it imposed...
Sir, If it works, you'll thank us. If it doesn't work, we have a lot of people to stand by you when the crap hits the fan. Clark noticed that Ding had moved casually from his post across the street, moving aimlessly, it seemed, like a tourist. Including you? Bet your ass, General, Clark replied, alert now, watching the people on the street. What had Chavez spotted? What had he missed? Who are they? Gone wondered. It took a second. Brigadier General Abraham Ben-Yakob, Deputy Director of the Mossad, his brain answered after sorting through all the recognition photographs he'd memorized. Talking to an American. I wonder who he is. Gone's head turned slowly and casually. The American would have several bodyguards. The one close by was obvious. A very serious fellow that one was. Old. Late 40s, perhaps. It was the hardness. No, not hardness, but alertness. One could control the face, but not the eyes. Ah, the man put sunglasses back on. More than one. Had to be more than one, plus Israeli security officers. Gone knew that he'd let his eyes linger a touch too long, but... Oops. A man had bumped into him, a fraction smaller and slighter than Gone. Dark complexion, possibly even a brother Arab, but he'd spoken in English. Contact was broken before Gone had time to realize that he'd been quickly and expertly frisked. Sorry. The man moved off. Gone didn't know, wasn't sure if it had been what it seemed to be, or if he'd just been checked out by an Israeli, American, or other security officer. Well, he wasn't carrying a weapon, not even a pocket knife, just a shopping bag full of books. Clark saw Ding give the all-clear sign, an ordinary gesture, like shooing an insect off his neck. Then why the eye recognition from the target? Anyone who took an interest in his protectee was a target. Why had he stopped and looked? Clark turned around. There was a pretty girl just two tables away. Not Arab or Israeli, some sort of European. Germanic language sounded like, maybe Dutch. Good-looking girl. And such girls attracted looks. Maybe he and the other two had just been between a looker and his lookee. Maybe. For a protective officer, the balance between awareness and paranoia was impossible to draw even when you understood the tactical environment, and Clark had no such illusions here. On the other hand, they'd selected a random eatery on a random street. And the fact that Ryan was here, and that Ben-Yakob and he had decided to look things over. Nobody had intelligence that good, and nobody had enough troops to cover even a single city, except maybe the Russians in Moscow, to make the threat a real one. But why the eye recognition? Well, Clark recorded the face, and it went into the memory hopper with all the hundreds of others. Gone continued his own patrol. He'd purchased all the books he needed and was now observing the Swiss troops, how they moved, how tough they looked. Avi Ben-Yakob, he thought. Missed opportunity. Targets like that one didn't appear every day. He continued down the rough, cobbled street, his eyes vacant as they appeared to scan at random. He'd take the next right, increase his pace, and try to get ahead of the Swiss before they made it to the next cross street. He both admired what he saw in them and regretted that he saw it. Nicely done, Ben-Yakob observed to Clark. Your subordinate is well trained. He shows promise. As Clark watched, Ding Chavez looped back to his lookout point across the street. You know the face? No. My people probably got a photograph. We'll check it out, but it was probably a young man with normal sexual drives. Ben-Yakob jerked his head toward the Dutch girl, if that's what she was. Clark was surprised the Israelis hadn't made a move. A shopping bag could contain anything, and anything had generally negative connotations in this environment. God, he hated this job.
Looking out for himself was one thing. He typically used mobility, random paths, irregular pacing, always keeping an eye out for escape routes or ambush opportunities. But Ryan, while he might have had similar instincts, tactically speaking, the DDCI was pretty swift, Clark judged, had an overdeveloped sense of faith in the competence of his two bodyguards.
So, Avi? Ryan asked.
Well,
the first echelon of your cavalry troops is settling in. Our tank people like your Colonel Diggs. I must say I find their regimental crest rather odd. The bison is just a kind of wild cow, after all.
Avi chuckled.
As with a tank, Avi, you probably don't want to stand in front of one.
Ryan wondered what would happen when the 10th Cav ran its first full-up training exercise with the Israelis. It was widely believed in the U.S. Army that the Israelis were overrated, and Diggs had a big reputation as a kick-ass tactician.
It looks like I can report to the President that the local situation is showing real signs of promise.
There will be difficulties.
Of course there will. Avi, the millennium doesn't arrive for a few more years, Jack noted. But did you think things would go so smoothly, so fast?
No, I didn't, Ben Jakob admitted.
He fished out the cash to pay the check, and both men rose. Clark took his cue and went over to Chavez.
Well, just that one guy. Heavy shopping bag, but it looked like books. Textbooks, matter of fact. There was a sales slip still in one. Would you believe books on nuclear physics? The one title I saw was, anyway. Big, thick, heavy mother. Maybe he's a grad student or something, and that is one pretty lady over there, man.
Let's keep our minds on business, Mr. Chavez.
She's not my type, Mr. Clark.
What do you think of the Swiss guys?
They look awful pretty for track toads. I wouldn't want to play with them unless I picked the turf and the time, man.
Chavez paused.
You notice the guy I frisked eyeballed them real hard?
No.
He did.
Looked like he knew what he was...
Domingo Chavez paused.
I suppose people around here seen a lot of soldiers. Anyway, he gave him a professional sort of look. That's what I noticed first, not the way he eyeballed you in the dock. The guy had smart eyes. You know what I mean?
What else?
Moved good, decent shape. Hands looked soft, though. Not hard like a soldier. Too old for a college kid, but maybe not for a grad student.
Chavez paused again.
Jesucristo, this is a paranoid business we're in, man. He was not carrying a weapon. His hands didn't look like he was a martial arts type. He just came down the street looking at those Swiss grunts, eyeballed over where the doc and his friend were, then he just kept going. End of story.
There were times when Chavez wished he'd opted to remain in the army. He would have had his degree and his commission by now, instead of cramming in night courses at George Mason while he played bodyguard to Ryan. At least the doc was a good guy, and working with Clark was... interesting. But this intelligence stuff was a strange life.
Time to move. Clark advised.
I got the point.
Ding's hand checked the automatic clipped under his loose shirt. The Israeli guards were already moving up the street. Gon caught them just as he'd planned. The Swiss had helped. An elderly Muslim cleric had stopped the squad sergeant to ask a question. There was a problem with translation. The imam didn't speak English, and the Swiss soldier's Arabic was still primitive. It was too good an opportunity to pass up.
Excuse me, Gon said to the imam. Can I help with translation?
He absorbed the rapid-fire string of his native language and turned to the soldier.
The imam is from Saudi Arabia. This is his first time in Jerusalem since he was a boy, and he requires directions to the Troika's office.
On recognizing the seniority of the cleric, the sergeant removed his helmet and inclined his head respectfully.
Please tell him that we would be honored to escort him there.
Ah, there you are,
another voice called. It was obviously an Israeli. His Arabic was accented but literate.
Good day, Sergeant, the man added in English. Greetings, Rabbi Ravenstein. Do you know this man? The soldier asked. This is Imam Mohammed Al-Faisal, a distinguished scholar and historian from Medina. Is it all I have been told? Al-Faisal asked Ravenstein directly. All that and more, the rabbi replied. Excuse me, Gon had to say. You are, Ravenstein asked, a student. I was attempting to assist with the language problem. Ah, I see, Ravenstein said. Very kind of you. Mohammed is here to look at a manuscript we uncovered at a dig. It's a scholarly Muslim commentary on a very old Torah, 10th century, a fantastic find. Sergeant, I can manage things from here, and thank you also, young man. Do you require escort, sir? The sergeant asked. We are heading that way. No, thank you. We are both too old to keep up with you. Very well. The sergeant saluted. Good day. The Swiss moved off. The few people who'd taken note of the brief encounter pointed and smiled. The commentary is by Al-Kalda himself, and it seems to cite the work of Nuchum of Acre, Ravenstein said. The state of preservation is incredible. Then I must see it. The two scholars began walking down the street as rapidly as their aged legs would carry them, oblivious to everything around them. Gon's face didn't change. He'd shown wonder and amusement for the benefit of the Swiss infantrymen, now halfway down the block, themselves with the trailing escort of small children. His discipline allowed him to sidle off to the side, take another turn, and vanish down a narrow alley. But what he had just seen was far more depressing. Mohammed Al-Faisal was one of the five greatest Islamic scholars, a highly respected historian, and a distant member of the Saudi royal family, despite his unpretentious nature. Except for his age, the man was nearing 80, he might have been one of the members of the troika running Jerusalem. That and the fact that they'd wanted a scholar of Palestinian ancestry for political reasons. No friend of Israel, and one of the most conservative of the Saudi religious leaders, had he become enamored of the treaty also? Worse still, the Swiss had treated the man with the utmost respect. Worst of all, the Israeli rabbi had done the same. The people in the streets, nearly all of them Palestinians, had watched it all with amusement and, what? Tolerance? Acceptance, as though it were the most natural thing in the world. The Israelis had long ago given lip service to respect for their Arab neighbors, but that promise had not even been written on sand for all the permanence it had carried. Ravenstein wasn't like that, of course. Another scholar, living in his own little world of dead things and ideas, he'd often counseled moderation in dealings with Arabs and handled his archaeological digs with Muslim consultation. And now he was a psychological bridge between the Jewish world and the Arab one. People like that would continue doing what they had always done, but now it was not an aberration, was it? Peace. It was possible. It could happen. It wasn't just another mad dream imposed on the region by outsiders. How quickly the ordinary people were adapting to it. Israelis were leaving their homes. The Swiss had already taken over one settlement and demolished several others. The Saudi Commission was set up and was beginning to work on restoring land parcels to their rightful owners. A great Arab university was planned for the outskirts of Jerusalem to be built with Saudi money. It was moving so fast. Israelis were resisting, but less than he had expected. In another week, he'd heard from 20 people. Tourists would flood the city. Hotel bookings were arriving as rapidly as satellite phone links could deliver them. Already two enormous new hotels were being planned for the influx, and on the basis of increased tourism alone, the Palestinians here would reap fantastic economic benefits. They were already proclaiming their total political victory over Israel, and had collectively decided to be magnanimous in their triumph. It made financial sense to be so. And the Palestinians had the most highly developed commercial sense in the Arab world.
but Israel would still survive. Gon stopped at a street cafe, set down his bag, and ordered a glass of juice. He contemplated the narrow street as he waited. There were Jews and Muslims. Tourists would soon flood the place. The first wave had barely broken at local airports. Muslims, of course, to pray at the Dome of the Rock. Americans with their money, even Japanese, curious about a land even more ancient than their own. Prosperity would soon come to Palestine. Prosperity was the handmaiden of peace and the assassin of discontent. But prosperity was not what Ibrahim Gon wanted for his people or his land. Ultimately, perhaps, but only after the other necessary preconditions had been met. He paid for his orange juice with American currency and walked off. Soon he was able to catch a cab. Gon had entered Israel from Egypt. He'd leave Jerusalem for Jordan, thence back to Lebanon. He had work to do, and he hoped the books he carried contained the necessary information. Ben Goodley was a postdoctoral student from Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. A bright, good-looking academic of 27 years, he was also possessed of enough ambition for the entire family after which the school had been named. His doctoral thesis had examined the folly of Vietnam from the intelligence side of the equation, and it had been sufficiently controversial that his professor had forwarded it to Liz Elliott for comment. The National Security Advisor's only beef with Goodley was that he was a man. Nobody was perfect. "So exactly what sort of research do you want to do?" she asked him. "Doctor, I hope to examine the nature of intelligence decisions as they relate to recent changes in Europe and the Middle East. The problem is getting FOI'd into certain areas." "And what is your ultimate objective?" "I mean," Elliot said, "is it teaching, writing, government service, what?" "Government service, of course. The historical environment demands, I think, that the right people take the right action. My thesis made it clear, didn't it, that we've been badly served by the intelligence community almost continuously since the 1960s. The whole institutional mindset over there is geared in the wrong direction." "At least," he leaned back and tried to look comfortable, "that's how it often appears to an outsider." "And why is that, do you think?" "Recruiting is one problem. The way CIA, for example, selects people really determines how they obtain and analyze data. They create a gigantic self-fulfilling prophecy. Where's their objectivity? Where's their ability to see trends? Did they predict 1989? Of course not. What are they missing now? Probably a lot of things." "It might be nice," Goodley said, "to get a handle on the important issues before they become crisis items." "I agree." Elliot watched the young man's shoulders drop as he discreetly let out a deep breath. She decided to play him just a little, just enough to let him know whom he'd be working for. "I wonder what we can do with you." Elliot let her eyes trace across the far wall. "Marcus Cabot has an opening for a research assistant. You'll need a security clearance, and you'll need to sign a very strict non-disclosure agreement. You cannot publish anything without having it cleared in advance." "That's almost prior restraint," Goodley pointed out. "What about the constitutional issue?" "Government must keep some secrets if it is to function. You may have access to some remarkable information. Is getting published your goal, or is it what you said? Public service does require some sacrifices." "Well, there will be some important openings at CIA in the next few years," Elliot promised. "I see," Goodley said, quite truthfully. "I never intended to publish classified information, of course." "Of course," Elliot agreed. "I can handle that through my office, I suppose. I found your paper impressive. I want a mind like yours working for the government, if you can agree to the necessary restrictions." "In that case, I guess I can accept them." Fine. Elliot smiled. You are now a White House fellow. My secretary will take you across the street to the security office. You have a bunch of forms to fill out. I already have a secret clearance. You'll need more than that. You'll have to get a SAP-SAR clearance. That means special access programs, special access required. It normally takes a few months for that. Months? Goodley asked. I said, usually. We can fast-track part of that. I suggest you start apartment hunting. The stipend is sufficient? Quite sufficient. Fine. I'll call Marcus over at Langley. You'll want to meet him. Goodley beamed at the National Security Advisor. Glad to have you on the team. The new White House fellow took his cue and stood. I will try not to disappoint you. Elliot watched him leave. It was so easy to seduce people, she knew. Sex was a useful tool for the task, but power and ambition were so much better. She'd already proven that. Elliot smiled to herself. An atomic bomb, Bach asked. So it would seem, Conti replied. Who else knows? Gone is the one who discovered it. Only he. Can it be used? The German asked. And why have you told me? It was severely damaged and must be repaired. Ibrahim is now assembling the necessary information for evaluating the task. He thinks it possible. Gunther leaned back. This is not some elaborate ruse. An Israeli trick. Perhaps an American one. If so, it is a very clever one, Kati said, then explained the circumstances of the discovery. 1973. It does fit. I remember how close the Syrians came to destroying the Israelis. Bach was silent for a moment. He shook his head briefly. How to use such a thing? That is the question, Gunther. Too early to ask such a question. First, you must determine if the weapon can be repaired. Second, you must determine its explosive yield. No? Before that, you must determine its size, weight, and portability. That is the most important consideration. After that comes the yield. I will assume that... He fell silent. Assume? I know little of such weapons. They cannot be too heavy. They can be fired from artillery shells of less than 20 centimeter diameter. I know that much. This one is much larger than that, my friend. You should not have told me this, Ismail. In a matter like this one, security is everything. You cannot trust anyone with knowledge such as this. People talk. People boast. There could be penetration agents in your organization. It was necessary. Gon knows that he will need some help. What contacts do you have in the DDR? What sort? Carty told him. I know a few engineers, people who've worked in the DDR nuclear program. It's a dead program, you know. How so? Honecker was planning to build several reactors of the Russian sort. When Germany reunited, the environmental activists took one look at the design and... Well, you can imagine. The Russian designs do not have a sterling reputation, do they? Bach grunted. As I keep telling you, the Russians are a backward people. Their reactor designs, one fellow told me, were mainly for production of nuclear material for weapons. And? And it is likely that there was a nuclear weapons program within the DDR. Interesting. I never thought that through. Did I? Bach asked himself quietly. What exactly do you want me to do? I need you to travel to Germany and find some people. We would prefer merely one, for obvious reasons, to assist us. Back to Germany? Bach asked himself. I'll need... Carty tossed an envelope into his friend's lap. Beirut has been a crossroads for centuries. Those travel documents are better than the real ones.
You will need to move your location immediately, Bach said. If I am caught, you will have to assume that they will get every bit of information I have. They broke Petra. They can break me or anyone else they wish. I will pray for your safety. In that envelope is a telephone number. When you return, we will be elsewhere.
When do I leave?
Tomorrow.
Chapter 12. Tinsmiths. And I'll raise you a dime, Ryan said after taking his draw. You're bluffing, Chavez said after a sip of beer. I never bluff, Jack replied. Out. Clark tossed in his cards. They all say that, the Air Force sergeant observed. See your dime and bump you a quarter. Call, Chavez said. Three jacks. Beats my eights, the sergeant groused. But not a straight, Doc. Ding finished off his beer. Gee, that puts me $5 ahead. Never count your winnings at the table, son, Clark advised soberly. I never did like that song, Chavez grinned. But I like this game. I thought soldiers were lousy gamblers, the Air Force sergeant observed sourly. He was $3 down, and he was a real poker player. He got to practice against politicians all the time on long flights when they needed a good dealer. One of the first things they teach you at CIA is how to mark cards, Clark announced as he went for the next round of drinks. Always knew I should have taken the course at the farm, Ryan said. He was about even, but every time he'd had a good hand, Chavez had held a better one. Next time I'll let you play with my wife. She good? Chavez asked. She's a surgeon. She deals seconds so smooth she can fool the professional mechanic. She plays with cards as a kind of dexterity exercise, Ryan explained with a grin. I never let her deal. Mrs. Ryan would never do anything like that, Clark said when he sat back down. Your turn to deal, Ding said. Clark started shuffling. Something he also did fairly well. So what do you think, Doc? Jerusalem? Better than I hoped. How about you? Last time I was there, 84, I think. God, it was like Olengapo in the PI. You could smell it. The trouble, I mean. You couldn't actually see it, but man, it was there. You could feel people watching you. Now? It's sure chilled out some. How about some 5-card stud? Clark asked. Dealer's choice, the sergeant agreed. Clark dealt the whole cards, then the first set of up cards. 9 of spades to the Air Force, 5 of diamonds to our Latino friend, queen of clubs to the duck, and the dealer gets... How about that? Dealer gets an ace. Ace bets a quarter. Well, John? Ryan asked after the first round of bets. You do put a lot of faith in my powers of observation, Jack. We'll know for sure in a couple of months, but I'd say it looks all right. He dealt 4 more cards. Possible straight. Possible straight flush to the Air Force. Your bet, sir. Another quarter. The Air Force sergeant felt lucky. The Israeli security guys have mellowed out some, too. How so? Dr. Ryan, the Israelis really know about security. Every time we fly over here, they put a wall up around the bird, you know? This time the wall wasn't so high. I talked to a couple of them, and they say they're more relaxed. Not officially, but personal, you know? Used to be they hardly talked at all. Looked like a big difference to me, anyway. Ryan smiled as he decided to fold. His 8, queen, and deuce weren't going anywhere. It never failed. You always got better data from sergeants than generals. What we have here, Gohn said, flipping his book to the right page, is essentially an Israeli copy of an American Mark 12 fission bomb. It's a boosted fission design. What does that mean? Kati asked.
It means that tritium is squirted into the core just as the act of firing begins. That generates more neutrons and greatly increases the efficiency of the reaction. As a result, you need only a small amount of fissionable material.
But, Kati heard the but coming. Gon leaned back and stared at the core of the device.
But the mechanism to insert the boost material was destroyed by the impact. The Crichton switches for the conventional explosives are no longer reliable and must be replaced. We have enough intact explosive blocks to determine their proper configuration, but manufacturing new ones will be very difficult. Unfortunately, I cannot depend on simply reverse engineering the entire weapon. I must duplicate the original design theoretically first, determine what it can and cannot do, then reinvent the processes for fabrication. Do you have any idea what the original cost for that was?
No, Kati admitted, sure that he was about to learn.
More than what it cost to land people on the moon. The most brilliant minds in human history were part of this process. Einstein, Fermi, Bohr, Oppenheimer, Teller, Alvarez, von Neumann, Lorentz, 100 others. The giants of physics in this century. Giants.
You're telling me you cannot do it? Gon smiled.
No, Commander. I am telling you that I can. What is the work of genius the first time is the work of a tinsmith soon thereafter. It required genius the first time because it was the first time, and also because technology was so primitive. All the calculations had to be done manually at first, on big mechanical calculators. All the work on the first hydrogen bomb was done on the first primitive computers. ENIAC, I think it was called.
But today, Gon laughed. It really was absurd. A video game has more computing power than ENIAC ever did. I can run the calculations on a high-end personal computer in seconds and duplicate what took Einstein months. But the most important thing is that they did not really know if it was possible. It is. And I know that. Next, they made records of how they proceeded. Finally, I have a template, and though I cannot reverse engineer it entirely, I can use this as a theoretical model.
You know, given 2 or 3 years, I could do it all myself.
Do you think we have 2 or 3 years? Gon shook his head. He'd already reported on what he saw in Jerusalem.
No, Commander. We surely do not.
Kati explained what he had ordered their German friend to do.
That is good. Where do we move to?
Berlin was once more the capital of Germany. It had been Bach's plan that this should be so, of course, but not that it should be this sort of Germany. He'd flown in from Italy, via Greece, and before that, Syria, and cleared passport control with scarcely a wave. From that point, he'd simply rented a car and driven out of Berlin on Highway E-74 north toward Greifswald. Gunther had rented a Mercedes-Benz. He rationalized this by telling himself that his cover was that of a businessman, and besides, he hadn't rented the biggest one available. There were times when he thought he might as well have rented a bicycle. This road had been neglected by the DDR government, and now that the Federal Republic was fully in place, the highway was little more than a linear repair gang. It went without saying that the other side of the road was already fixed. His peripheral vision caught hundreds of big, powerful Benzes and BMWs streaking south toward Berlin as the capitalists from the west blazed about to reconquer economically what had collapsed under political betrayal. Bach took his exit outside Greifswald, driving east through the town of Chemnitz. The attempts at road repair had not yet reached the secondary roads. After hitting half a dozen potholes, Gunther had to pull over and consult his map. He proceeded 3 kilometers, then made a series of turns, ending up on what had once been an upscale neighborhood of professionals. In the driveway of the house he sought was a Trabant. The grass was still neatly trimmed, of course, and the house was neatly arranged, down to the even curtains in the windows.
This was Germany, after all. But there was an air of disrepair and depression, not so much seen as felt. Bach parked his car a block away and walked an indirect route back to the house. "I am here to see Herr Dr. Fromm," he told the woman, Frau Fromm, probably, who answered the door.
"Who, may I say, is calling?" she asked formally.
She was in her middle 40s, her skin tight over severe cheeks, with too many lines radiating from her dull blue eyes and tight, colorless lips. She examined the man on her front step with interest and perhaps a little hope. Though Bach had no idea why this should be so, he took the chance to make use of it. "An old friend," Bach smiled to reinforce the image. "May I surprise him?" She wavered for a moment, then her face changed, and good manners took hold.
"Please, come in."
Bach waited in the sitting room, and he realized that his impression was right. But why it was right struck him hard. The interior of the house reminded him of his own apartment in Berlin, the same specially made furniture that had once looked so good in contrast to what was available for ordinary citizens in the German Democratic Republic, did not impress as it once had. Perhaps it was the Mercedes he'd driven up, Bach told himself as he heard footsteps approaching. But no, it was dust. Frau Fromm was not cleaning the house as a good German Hausfrau did, a sure sign that something was badly wrong.
"Yes," Dr. Manfred Fromm said as a question, before his eyes widened in delayed recognition.
"Ah, so good to see you."
"I wondered if you'd remember your old friend Hans," Bach said with a chuckle, stretching out his hand. "A long time, Manfred."
"A very long time indeed, Junger. Come to my study."
The two men walked off under the inquisitive eyes of Frau Fromm. Dr. Fromm closed the door behind himself before speaking.
"I am sorry about your wife. It was unspeakable what happened."
"That is past.
How are you doing?"
"You haven't heard?
The Greens have attacked us. We're about to shut down."
Dr. Manfred Fromm was, on paper, the deputy assistant director of the Lubmin Nord nuclear power station. The station had been built 20 years earlier from the Soviet VVER Model 230 design, which, primitive as it was, had been adequate with an expert German operations team. Like all Soviet designs of the period, the reactor was a plutonium producer. But unlike Chernobyl, it had a containment dome. It was neither terribly efficient nor especially unsafe, but did carry the benefit of producing weapons-grade nuclear material in addition to 816 megawatts of electrical power from its two functioning reactors.
"The Greens," Bach repeated quietly. "Them."
The Green Party was a natural consequence of the German national spirit, which venerated all growing things on one hand, while trying very hard to kill them on the other. Formed from the extreme, or the consistent, elements of the environmental movement, it had fought against many things equally upsetting to the communist bloc. But where it had failed to prevent the deployment of theater nuclear weapons, and after their successful deployment had resulted in the INF Treaty, which had eliminated all such weapons on both sides of the line, it was now successfully raising the purest form of political hell in what had once been the German Democratic Republic. The nightmare of pollution in the East was now the obsession of the Greens, and number one on their hit list was the nuclear power industry, which they called hideously unsafe. Bach reminded himself that the Greens had never truly been under proper political control. The party would never be a major power in German politics, and now it was being exploited by the same government that it had once annoyed. Whereas once the Greens had shrieked about the pollution of the Ruhr and the Rhine from Krupp, and howled about the deployment of NATO nuclear arms, now they were crusading in the East more fervently than Barbarossa had ever attempted in the Holy Land. Their incessant carping on the mess in the East was ensuring that socialism would not soon return to Germany. It was enough to make both men wonder if the Greens had not been a subtle capitalist ploy from the very beginning. Fromm and the Bachs had met 5 years earlier. The Red Army faction had come up with a plan to sabotage a West German reactor and wanted technical advice on how to do so most efficiently. Though never revealed to the public, their plan had been thwarted only at the last minute. Publicity on the BND's intelligence success would conversely have threatened Germany's own nuclear industry.
Less than a year until they shut us down for good. I only go into work 3 days a week now. I've been replaced by a technical expert from the West. He lets me advise him, of course, Frome reported.
There must be more, Manfred, Bach observed. Frome had also been the chief engineer in Erich Honecker's most cherished military project. Though allies within the World Socialist Brotherhood, the Russians and the Germans could never have been true friends. The bad blood between the nations stretched back 1,000 years, and while Germany had at least made a go of socialism, the Russians had failed completely. As a result, the East German military had never been anything like the much larger force in the West. To the last, the Russians had feared the Germans, even those on their own side, before incomprehensibly allowing the country to be unified. Erich Honecker had decided that such distrust might have strategic ramifications, and had drawn plans to keep some of the plutonium produced at Greifswald and elsewhere. Manfred Frome knew as much about nuclear bomb design as any Russian or American, even if he'd never quite been able to put his expertise into play. The plutonium stockpile secretly accumulated over 10 years had been turned over to the Russians as a final gesture of Marxist fealty, lest the federal German government get it. That last honorable act had resulted in angry recriminations, angry enough that one other cache of material had never been turned over. What connections Frome and his colleagues had once had with the Soviets were completely gone.
Oh, I have a fine offer.
Frome lifted a manila envelope on his cluttered desk.
They want me to go to Argentina. My counterparts in the West have been there for years, along with most of the chaps I worked with.
What do they offer? Frome snorted.
1 million D-mark per year until the project is completed. No difficulties with taxes, numbered account. All the normal enticements, Frome said with an emotionless voice. And that, of course, was quite impossible. Frome could no more work for fascists than he could breathe water.
His grandfather, one of the original Spartacists, had died in one of the first labor camps soon after Hitler's accession to power. His father had been part of the communist underground and a player in a spy ring, had somehow survived the war despite the systematic hunting of the Gestapo and the Sicherheitsdienst, and been an honored local party member to the day of his death. Frome had learned Marxism-Leninism while he'd learned to walk, and the elimination of his profession had not enamored him of the new political system which he'd been educated to despise. He'd lost his job, had never fulfilled his prime ambition, and was now being treated like an office boy by some pink-cheeked engineer's assistant from Göttingen. Worst of all, his wife wanted him to take the job in Argentina and was making a further hell of his life so long as he refused to consider it. Finally, he had to ask his question.
Why are you here, Gunther?
The entire country is looking for you, and despite that fine disguise, you are in danger here. Bach smiled confidently.
Isn't it amazing what new hair and glasses can do for you?
That does not answer my question.
I have friends who need your skills.
What friends might those be? Frome asked dubiously.
They are politically acceptable to me and to you.
I have not forgotten, Petra, Bach replied.
That was a good plan we put together, wasn't it? What went wrong?
We had a spy among us. Because of her, they changed the security arrangements at the plant 3 days before we were supposed to go in.
A green?
Gunther allowed himself a bitter smile.
Yeah.
She had second thoughts about possible civilian casualties and damage to the environment.
Well, she is now part
of the environment. Petra had done the shooting, her husband remembered. There was nothing worse than a spy, and it was fitting that Petra should have done the execution. Part of the environment, you say? How poetic. It was Fromm's first attempt at levity, and about as successful as all his attempts. Manfred Fromm was a singularly humorless man. I cannot offer you money. In fact, I cannot tell you anything else. You must decide on the basis of what I have already said. Bach didn't have a gun, but he did have a knife. He wondered if Manfred knew the alternatives he faced. Probably not. Despite his ideological purity, Fromm was a technocrat and narrowly focused.
When do we leave?
Are you being watched?
No.
I had to travel to Switzerland for the business offer. Such things cannot be discussed in this country, even if it is united and happy, he explained. I made my own travel arrangements. No, I do not think I am being watched.
Then we can leave at once.
You need not pack anything.
What do I tell my wife? Fromm asked, then wondered why he'd bothered. It wasn't as though his marriage was a happy one.
That is your concern.
Let me pack some things. It's easier that way. How long?
I do not know. It took half an hour. Fromm explained to his wife that he was going to be away for a few days for further business discussions. She gave him a hopeful kiss. Argentina might be nice, and nicer still to be able to live well somewhere. Perhaps this old friend had been able to talk sense into him. He drove a Mercedes, after all. Perhaps he knew what the future really held.
3 hours later, Bach and Fromm boarded a flight to Rome. After an hour's layover, their next stop was Turkey, and from there to Damascus, where they checked into a hotel to get some needed rest.
If anything, Gone told himself, Marvin Russell was even more formidable looking than he'd been before. What little excess weight he'd carried had sweated off, and his daily fitness exercises with the soldiers of the movement had only added to an already muscular physique, while the sun had bronzed him until he might almost have been mistaken for an Arab. The one discordant note was his religion. His comrades reported that he was a true pagan, an unbeliever who prayed to the sun of all things. It disquieted the Muslims, but people were working gently to show him the true faith of Islam, and it was reported that he listened respectfully. It was also reported that he was a dead shot with any weapon to any range, that he was the most lethal hand-to-hand fighter they'd ever encountered, he'd nearly crippled an instructor, and that he had fieldcraft skills that would impress a fox. A clever, cunning, natural warrior was the overall assessment. Aside from his religious eccentricities, the others liked and admired him.
Marvin, if you get any tougher, you will frighten me.
Gone chuckled at his American friend.
Ibrahim, this is the best thing I've ever done coming here. I never knew that there were other folks who'd been fucked over like my people, man. But you guys are better at fighting back. You guys got real balls.
Gone blinked at that. This from a man who'd snapped a policeman's neck like a twig.
I really want to help, man, any way I can.
There is always a place for a true warrior.
If his language skills improved, he'd make a fine instructor, Gone thought.
Well, I must be off.
Where you going?
A place we have east of here.
It was to the north.
Some special work I must do.
That thing we dug up? Russell asked casually.
Almost too casually, Gone thought. But that was not possible, was it? Caution was one thing. Paranoia was another.
Something else. Sorry, my friend, but we must take our security seriously.
Marvin nodded.
It's cool, man. That's what killed my brother, fucking up security. See you when you get back.
Gone left for his car and drove out of the camp. He took the Damascus Road for an hour. Foreigners so often failed to appreciate how small the Middle East was.
The important parts, at least. The drive from Jerusalem to Damascus, for example, would have been a mere 2 hours on decent roads, though the two cities were the proverbial worlds apart politically. Or had been, Gon reminded himself. He'd heard of some ominous rumblings from Syria of late.